Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Thousands of refugees streamed through Europe Thursday facing torrential rains on the Macedonian border with Greece, even as further to the north, Austria halted train service with Hungary because of massive overcrowding. The European Parliament, in a non-binding vote, overwhelmingly supported the call by European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker for country-by-country mandatory quotas to accept 160,000 refugees, mostly from war-torn Syria, over the next 2 years. The United States pledged Wednesday to accept more refugees from Syria and elsewhere, although no number has been announced. Heavy rains in already drenched areas of central and northern Japan caused major flooding Thursday, forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate and setting off dramatic rescues of those who could not get out in time. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports.
We have a type of scene that Japan has not witnessed since March 11, 2011, when a major tsunami hit the northeast coast of Japan. However, this time, it is weather-related. Rains going on for days around the Tokyo metropolitan area have forced rivers over their banks. And in the case of the Kinugawa River in nearby Ibaraki Prefecture, the levees have broken, and thousands and thousands of homes have been inundated by water. We're hearing that as many as 90,000 people have now evacuated their residences, and there are dramatic scenes of helicopters plucking people from the waters.
That is VOA correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Tokyo. This is VOA News. China's foreign minister said Thursday the government was looking into the reported kidnapping of a Chinese national by Islamic State militants. The comment came a day after the militant group published in its online magazine the photos of two men and demanded unspecified ransom for their release. It identified them as 50-year-old Fan Jinghui of China and 48-year-old Ole Johan Grimsgård Ofsted of Norway. The report did not say when the hostages were captured or where they are being held. Norway's Prime Minister Erna Solberg said Wednesday that authorities learned of the possible kidnapping of a Norwegian man in his 40s in Syria at the end of January, and that they believe he is being held captive by the Islamic State group. Iran says it has not yet decided how to reduce its enriched uranium stockpile, which it must do under the July 14 nuclear deal it signed with six world powers. Iran envoy Reza Najafi said one option would be to export it to Russia or other countries. The other, he says, would be to convert it to non-enriched form. Najafi, Iran's chief envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, spoke to reporters Thursday outside a board meeting of the 35-nation agency.
We are discussing other ways. The other option, one way would be the changing, converting the extract stockpile or exporting to the other countries.
Russia?
One possibility is Russia, yes.
Uranium can be enriched to levels all the way to weapons grade, which is used in fissile core of nuclear arms. Iran says it is not interested in such weapons and enriches only to produce energy for peaceful research. The United States and NATO have reacted with concern to reports of increased Russian military presence in Syria. A senior U.S. defense official told VOA that Russia has been airlifting military supplies to Syria, calling such activities unhelpful. State Department spokesman John Kirby told reporters he did not have confirmation of a Russian buildup, but that Russia's intent here is unclear. Prague NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg expressed similar concern about reported Russian deployments of military personnel and aircraft to Syria. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said in a statement Wednesday, Russian military experts are in Syria to help its military master the use of Russian weaponry and other equipment. A new political survey in the U.S. shows Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders edging ahead of former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Iowa, the rural state where voters in February will start to select the party's 2016 presidential nominee. Quinnipiac University poll released Thursday indicates Sanders is supported by 41% of the state's Democratic voters to 40% for Clinton, a marked change from 2 months ago when Clinton held a 19-point lead in Iowa. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The World Food Program says it is scaling up aid for hundreds of thousands of hungry people, many severely malnourished, who have fled to Chad, Niger, and Cameroon to escape attacks by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, members of the European Parliament meeting in Brussels today backed the EU Commissioner's formula for allocating more than 160,000 migrants among most of 28 member nations.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Benin, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, members of the European Parliament meeting in Brussels today backed the EU Commissioner Jean-Claude Juncker's formula for allocating more than 160,000 migrants among most of 28 member nations. Today's support paves the way for a final vote in Brussels on Monday by the home ministers of the EU states. The extraordinary meeting of the ministers will require a majority approval for passage of a plan that makes settlement of the migrants mandatory. The leaders of many EU countries blocked an earlier EU plan to move 40,000 asylum seekers from overburdened Italy, Greece, and Hungary.
A network of non-governmental organizations working to protect children in armed conflicts has released a report on the state of children in Central African Republic today. The group called Watchlist says ex-Seleka and ex-Balaka groups regularly loot schools and threaten children and teachers. It urges the transitional government to take urgent steps to secure educational facilities and to promote a child's right to education. Its findings are based on interviews with 178 people, including 22 students and 57 school staff. Watchlist formally presented its report to the public at the UN today. Among the speakers was the author of the report and research officer, Janine Morna. She says the attacks have taken a heavy toll on the country's education system. An earlier assessment done earlier this year estimates that 29% of schools in CAR have been attacked by militants.
The most common types of attacks are looting of schools, followed closely by threats against students and education personnel, and finally indiscriminate attacks that cause damage to school property. Watchlist documented pervasive, ongoing, and very serious cases of school looting. About 70% of the schools surveyed by the education cluster that had been attacked had also been looted. When armed groups move into villages, they occupy school spaces and loot the school facilities. Even when the armed groups are not using the school facilities, they've also broken into schools to steal materials. They've taken school doors, tables, chairs, textbooks to use as firewood, and sold valuable materials like metal roofs and other school laboratory equipment for profit. In recent months, armed groups have also targeted, humanitarian groups have spent a lot of effort rehabilitating school facilities. This includes specifically targeting valuable feeding programs to draw students back to school. Unfortunately, these feeding programs have also drawn a lot of attacks by armed groups. So, for example, a director for a school in Bangui told Watchlist about an anti-Balaka base behind his school. They intercepted a delivery of food to the school. They threatened the humanitarian actors and the school directors, and later that night stole all the food for the feeding program. Now, there are about 1.6 million people in need of food assistance in the Central African Republic, and feeding programs are critical to providing or improving children's nutritional status. Almost every school visited by Watchlist with a feeding program had food supplies stolen.
Watchlist found that armed groups threatened both students and teachers in over 8% of all schools surveyed. In June, anti-Balaka factions attacked peacekeepers outside a school in Bangui, resulting in 80 students being sent to medical facilities for treatment. Morna says in late 2014, groups and vigilantes targeted schools possibly because they represent a return to stability and normality. The watchlist study also found many students take long detours to avoid insecure areas on their way to and from school. Armed groups also failed to protect schools when they attacked villages or burned them to the ground.
Watchlist also documented cases of armed groups and, on occasion, international peacekeeping forces using schools. Now, while there's no explicit legal prohibition on the military use of schools, during armed conflict, international human rights law remains in effect, and government forces must respect and protect children's right to education. Several UN Security Council resolutions also express concern about the use of schools for military purposes. Armed groups have used schools as lodging facilities and, on occasion, as bases to carry out logistical and operational tasks, such as to host meetings, store school materials, wash their vehicles, or as guard posts. They've sought out schools because of their good infrastructure, offering ideal conditions for lodging and sometimes strategic positioning. International forces have played a really vital role in stabilizing many areas of Kar. However, as part of that process, on occasion, they too have also had to use schools for their operations. Between 2012 and January 2015, the education cluster received 11 reports of African Union-led MISCA forces, Operation Sangari forces, and UN MINUSCA forces using schools. Now, Watchlist visited two schools where Operation Sangari forces and MISCA forces were allegedly invited by local authorities to set up bases to help stabilize the town. Their use contributed to the damage of the two buildings and delayed the reopening of the schools. Now, following the establishment of MINUSCA and the rehatting of MISCA troops into MINUSCA, NGOs and local communities have reported fewer cases of international forces using schools. We suspect this is because the UN has a prohibition on peacekeepers using schools in their operations and have taken steps to sensitize their troops on this policy and to respond to reports of international forces using schools. Watchlist encourages other international peacekeeping forces to examine and strengthen their policies on this practice as well.
Schools in CAR officially reopened in January 2014. Evidence suggests many Muslim students no longer attend. Some have fled. Others are afraid to leave their neighbors. Rumors and threats of attacks also prevent attendance. Poor security prevents many qualified teachers from returning to work. In response, schools often depend on community volunteers. Morna congratulates the transitional government for signing a safe schools declaration. It promises to protect education and prevent military from using schools and universities. Watchlist wants the guidelines incorporated into legislation and military doctrine. It also wants the government to incorporate provisions of the Rome Statute into their criminal code. Morna says this way it can prosecute people who attack schools. She says the international community and national actors can support these efforts by strengthening the monitoring of attacks on schools and military use of facilities. It can help support efforts to support a secure environment around schools.
Cameroon's government says it has disbursed $12 million to calm angry soldiers protesting the non-payment of their salaries for service as international peacekeepers in the Central African Republic. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
At least 200 soldiers blocked traffic on some streets in the capital Yaoundé Wednesday before moving to the National Assembly and the Defense Headquarters. They demanded that all money owed them for their service in the CAR be paid. Cameroon's Minister of Communication, Issa Chiruma, says Cameroon had paid all the salaries of the soldiers and what is remaining are allowances the African Union has yet to pay.
The minister delegate at the presidency in charge of defense went to the headquarters of the African Union in Addis Ababa to clarify this very serious issue with the Peace and Security Commission of the African Union. Assurances were then given that all measures were taken to finalize the procedure for the full payment of these arrears.
In the meantime, Chiruma says Cameroon President Paul Biya has ordered that $12 million be withdrawn from the public treasury to pay the soldiers' dues. Chiruma asked the soldiers to return to their barracks. Cameroon has deployed 1,300 troops to the CAR since 2014 as part of a UN peacekeeping mission to calm sectarian violence that began in 2013. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehisu Heap, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Members of the European Parliament meeting in Brussels today backed the EU Commissioner's formula for allocating more than 160,000 migrants among most of 28 member nations. And the World Food Programme says it is scaling up aid for hundreds of thousands of hungry people who have fled to Chad, Niger and Cameroon to escape attacks by Boko Haram militants. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The World Food Program, WFP, says it is scaling up aid to hundreds of thousands of hungry people. Many are severely malnourished. The refugees have fled to Chad, Niger, and Cameroon to escape attacks by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The World Food Program says nearly 750,000 people in countries bordering Nigeria are facing a worsening food crisis linked to increased violence by Boko Haram militants. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia tells VOA that recent attacks have led to a sudden surge of internally displaced people and refugees.
We are quite concerned about people are really afraid of the Boko Haram. They are telling harrowing stories about fleeing from the violence, being on the run, sometimes traveling for several days. And we have to make sure that especially the children and moms are being taken care of.
WFP says it plans to increase food aid to more than 650,000 vulnerable people in Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. The agency warns the security crisis playing out in the region could lead to prolonged hunger. Impacts from this emergency already are visible. WFP reports a dramatic rise in malnutrition among children under 5 and women in the areas affected by Boko Haram violence. It says acute malnutrition rates in some areas of Chad have passed the World Health Organization's emergency threshold of 22.5%. In addition, WFP spokeswoman Lucia says people's livelihoods in the countries of refuge are being severely disrupted.
Closed borders have disrupted trade. They have halted access to farmland, prevented herders from reaching grazing land. Fishing, which is a really important part for living for many people in Chad, is banned for security reasons. And in Chad, rural households in affected areas sold more livestock than in a normal year, meaning they're trying to get some money in order to buy food.
Lucia says people are resorting to extreme measures to survive. She says 1 in 3 households reportedly are falling into debt and selling whatever they have to obtain food. She says WFP is appealing for $16.3 million to respond to this emergency. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says the majority of Nigerian children suffer violent abuse. The report says the abuse starts, for some kids, before their 5th birthday. Christine reports from Lagos.
The report's findings released Thursday paint a grim picture of children's lives in Nigeria. It says that 6 out of 10 children experience some form of violence before they turn 18, with half of them experiencing physical violence. Others are abused emotionally or sexually. The violence starts young. Over half of children were abused before the age of 11, and 1 in 10 were abused before they turned 5. The abuse is rarely done, only once. Rachel Harvey is the chief of child protection for UNICEF in Nigeria.
For around about 80% of children, this would happen again and again and again. And also, children often suffered more than one type of violence as well.
Most children find themselves facing the abuse alone. Those abused mostly know their abusers, Harvey said. They tend to be parents, other relatives, or male teachers.
Children revealed that they didn't know where to go. The majority of children don't know where to seek help.
The first of its kind in Africa, Harvey says this survey covered all of Nigeria's 36 states and the federal capital territory. Nigeria has been struggling with numerous security crises in recent years, including an insurgency by Islamist Boko Haram militants in its northeast, and clashes between farmers and herdsmen in its north-central middle belt. But Harvey says this survey was intended to show that violence against children extends beyond these areas.
The purpose of this survey was bringing to the spotlight that the violence against children is not just happening to marginalized groups, not just happening in the context-affected areas. It's happening in communities, in homes. It's not someone else's problem. It's really everybody's problem.
Harvey says the abuse becomes cyclical. Children who suffer abuse often grow up to abuse their partners. President Muhammadu Buhari is expected to unveil the government's response to the UNICEF report next week. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The one-year countdown has begun for the world's largest environmental summit. The IUCN World Conservation Congress will be held in Hawaii under the theme Planet at the Crossroads. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The IUCN, or International Union for Conservation of Nature, is the world's oldest and largest global environmental organization. It publishes what it calls a red list of threatened, endangered, or critically endangered species. The environmental summit will be held about 1 year after this month's adoption of the new UN Sustainable Development Goals and December's Paris Climate Conference, known as COP21. IUCN Director General Inger Andersen says attending those meetings is not enough. What's important, she says, is implementing any agreements.
Assuming, of course, that we have very positive outcomes from the SDG summit, a good agreement in Paris, we will see in 1 year out 6,000 to 8,000 delegates gathered from around the world and representatives from government, indigenous peoples, academia, etc. And what we're trying to do now is to move the environmental agenda to have a much greater impact on the way in which we interact with our world, our planet, and our nature to ensure more sustainable growth paths for the future.
She says the theme, Planet at the Crossroads, is a reminder that environmental protection and human growth go hand in hand.
It is not about either we choose environment or we choose growth and well-being and development. In fact, we have choices that are available to us. What we refer to as nature-based solutions that are credible and accessible choices, they really do exist, and they can promote the general welfare while also ensuring that we enhance the planetary welfare and the planet's natural assets.
The choices made, Andersen says, will determine the future of the planet.
We are seeing extinction of species. We're seeing ecosystem collapse. But this is not a problem that we cannot turn around. And we are the crossroads at which we have to make the right decision.
When the IUCN World Conservation Congress is held in Honolulu next September, it will be the first time the summit is held in the U.S.
We were very happy to receive very strong endorsement from U.S. President Barack Obama for holding this conference and Congress in Hawaii. IUCN is a membership-based organization. We're very proud that we have both government members, including the State Department, as well as many other countries. But we also have NGO members. Having both as members means that we can, in fact, amp up the volume of commitment.
The IUCN Director General says the summit will include the Members' Assembly, which will identify the most significant conservation concerns and trends that will guide the organization's work in the coming years. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Iron supplements do not increase the risk of pregnant women contracting malaria in endemic countries and could even be beneficial. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
Many doctors recommend that pregnant women who suffer from anemia be given supplements to raise the level of iron, an essential nutrient in their blood. But that rarely occurs in developing countries, experts say, given all of the other health challenges they face, including higher rates of malaria. There's some evidence that iron supplementation increases the risk of malaria in children. It's thought the immediate production of new blood cells after treatment begins makes the kids more attractive targets for disease-carrying mosquitoes. But a new study in Kenya found virtually no difference in malaria risk among pregnant women who took iron supplements and those who didn't. Hans Bierhoff, a clinical epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, led the study of 470 pregnant women, 60% of whom were anemic at the beginning. He says the extra iron given to half of those women increased the duration of their pregnancy and the weight of their newborns.
So in those women, we do find an increase in birth weight by 250 grams, which is absolutely massive. Our study indicates that that iron supplementation certainly should go full steam ahead, and we should really try to increase coverage of that.
Low birth weight increases the risk of infant death and disabilities. While iron supplements appeared to improve pregnancy outcomes, it had no impact on malaria infection. 50% of the women given iron contracted the disease, compared to just over half of the women who received a placebo or an active pill. The findings were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, along with a commentary by Robert Black with the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. While he welcomed the news that iron supplements did not raise the risk of malaria, he warned against relying on them to protect against the disease.
Where that prevention or treatment of malaria is not present or not very strong, we don't know if there could be some risk. So I think that's the only caveat. But I think when the iron is given in the malaria setting, it's very important to deal with the malaria as well as provide the iron.
The authors note that their results may apply to pregnant women in other low and middle income countries, although the effect on birth weight can vary depending on the prevalence of iron deficiency. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
African Music Mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Members of the European Parliament meeting in Brussels today backed the EU Commissioner's formula for allocating more than 160,000 migrants among most of 28 member nations. And the World Food Program says it is scaling up aid for hundreds of thousands of hungry people who have fled to Chad, Niger, and Cameroon to escape attacks by Boko Haram militants. Coming up, we'll have music from Benin, and in our feature segment, efforts to improve educational standards in Cameroon. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are beginning with the All-Africa Games.
Kim, action is continuing at the 11th All-Africa Games in Congo, Brazzaville. Heading into Thursday's various sports competitions, Egypt and South Africa are comfortably on top of the medals table. The Egyptians had won a total of 93 medals, 31 gold, 31 silver, and 31 bronze. The South Africans had 67 medals, 29 gold, 22 silver, and 16 bronze. Nigeria had reason to cheer Wednesday when it came to All-Africa Games football. Nigeria's men's team beat defending All-Africa Games champion Ghana 2-0 on second-half goals by Junior Ajayi and Kingsley Sakari. And Nigeria's women's team scored its second consecutive victory, topping Tanzania 3-0. And let's give a Sunny Side of Sports shout-out for Nigerian striker Desire Oparanozie, who played for her country's senior team, the Super Falcons, at this year's Women's World Cup in Canada. Desire scored 2 goals against Tanzania. And after her hat trick against host Congo Brazzaville in Nigeria's opening match, a 5-1 victory, Desire is the tournament's leading scorer with 5 goals. In another women's result Wednesday, Ivory Coast edged the host Congolese 1-0 on a goal by Rita Akafu in the 38th minute. The Ivorian women and the Nigerian women each have the maximum 6 points from 2 matches in Group A, and they're through to the semifinals in Brazzaville. Meanwhile, in All-Africa Games swimming, 2-time Olympic champion Kirsty Coventry won Zimbabwe's first medal, a gold, in the women's 100 meters backstroke event. Mary Cloppers is the president of the Zimbabwe Aquatic Union. In a telephone interview from Harare with reporter Marvelous Malanga Nyahuye, she said Zimbabweans are thrilled with Coventry's swimming success.
We're very excited about it. She's on track. For us, that just means that she's on track. She's achieving what she needs to be achieving. And we are just behind her 100% in her quest to go and conquer at Rio again.
What impact do you think this gold medal will have, especially for those that are thinking of taking up swimming?
Kirsty is idolized in Zimbabwe. I mean, and this is just going to bring her achievements and the possibilities for any future stars to the fore again. So it is fantastic for our sport. And we owe a lot to Kirsty for her contribution in that way.
Are you then preparing a lavish spread for her when she does complete her tour in Brazzaville? Or what have you got lined up for her?
She's actually going straight back to America, straight back into her training routine. So she won't be coming back via Zimbabwe. But whenever she is in Zimbabwe, we know that she's here and she's treated very well.
That's Mary Cloppers, the president of the Zimbabwe Aquatic Union. And Mary was talking with reporter Marvelous Malanga Nyahuye from Harare. Our African football guru, David Legg, is looking at the recent 2017 Nations Cup qualifiers played all across the continent. There were 25 matches spanning all 13 qualifying groups. In Group F, Morocco scored a 3-0 road victory over Sao Tome and Principe, and the Cape Verde Islands beat Libya 2-1 in a match played in Cairo, Egypt. The game was played in the Egyptian capital because of the unstable security situation in Libya. David, what's your take on Group F?
This one is looking like a Cape Verde-Morocco battle. Both have got 6 points, and their two rivals have got no points. The Sao Tome result was very predictable. Sao Tome losing 7-1 away to Cape Verde on match day one. So they were clearly a side battling at this level of football. Morocco went to the island state off the west coast, and three goals late in the first half from Amrabat, El Arabi, and El Arabi, of course, that name we mention very often when we're doing our European roundups. He plays in the Spanish La Liga, and he's a consistent scorer. And also Dirar, they were the three Moroccan scorers. Quite a lot of drama in Cairo between Libya and Cape Verde. It finished 2-1, but the Libyans will feel, of course, that it should have been 3-2 to them, because they were awarded two penalties and fluffed both of them. Now, it's not uncommon for one penalty to be missed, but certainly unusual for a team to be awarded two penalties, two different penalty takers, incidentally, and neither of them managed to score. Cape Verde took the lead early in the second half. Libya equalized with 4 minutes left. And I'm sure the Mediterranean Knights, as they're known, felt that they would now get at least a draw. But unfortunately for them, Mendes popped up in the final minute to snatch a 2-1 away victory for Cape Verde. So Cape Verde and Morocco, 6 points each. Libya and Sao Tome, no points yet. That situation will change, Sonny, on match day three, because Sao Tome and Libya are paired. And the big one, Cape Verde versus Morocco.
We turn to Group G now, David. In Dar es Salaam, Tanzania and Nigeria play to a scoreless draw. And in N'Djamena, Egypt, big 5-1 winners over Chad. How does this group look, David?
Yes, Sonny, I noticed you put an emphasis there on the word big. I don't think even the most partisan supporter of the Pharaohs, while hoping that Egypt would win in Chad, ever imagined 5-1. That, Sonny, was quite a scoreline. And what that indicates to me is that the Pharaohs are back in business. After winning a record three consecutive Cup of Nations titles, they failed to qualify for the last three tournaments, and that for Egypt was deeply humiliating. How can you go from conquering Africa three times in a row to not even making the finals of the Cup of Nations? Various reasons, Sonny, the political situation in Egypt, the security situation in Egypt, the retirement of some great Egyptian footballers, including the one and only Mohamed Aboutrika. These were contributing factors, and a lot of violence at some Egyptian football matches. It meant that crowds were banned. It meant that clubs had far less revenue, and therefore the standard of players they were able to sign dropped. So there were certainly contributing factors to the lowering of standards in the national team, and we saw that very strongly in the playoffs for the 2014 World Cup when Ghana hammered Egypt by 6-1 and basically rendered the return match meaningless. But now Egypt looked like they're on the road to recovery. In their first match, they hammered the Tanzanians by 3-0. Then they go to Chad. Bassem Morsi, now we have mentioned his name before. He plays for Zamalek. He's a young, bearded striker. He scored a hat-trick, and there were also goals from Salah and Karaba. Now, Karaba is a name I mentioned fairly recently, Sonny, and I'm going to repeat what I said on your show. Watch out for this player. He, to me, is a future star, not only of Egypt, but of Africa. He could even, dare I say it, be the new Aboutrika. He's a midfielder, and he scores an awful lot of goals. Chad, their one goal came late in the first half. They trailed 3-1 at halftime, and I guess they were wishing for the final whistle long before it actually sounded. Nigeria, on the other hand, disappointed in Tanzania. They were held to a 0-0 draw. This was the first game in charge for their new Super Eagles coach, Sunday Alisi, and they started promisingly. They used the width to attack the Tanzanian defense, and there were a couple of close shaves. But then an unlikely hero emerged for the Nigerians, and he was 29-year-old Carl Ikemi. Carl Ikemi was brought into the squad as an understudy for Vincent Enyeama, but Vincent Enyeama became unavailable both as goalkeeper and captain. So Ekemi took over between the sticks and produced a series of very fine saves. One of his parents is Nigerian. He was born in England, and he plays for second-tier club Wolverhampton Wanderers. So an interesting situation has now developed, Sonny, in this battle, this big battle between Egypt and Nigeria, in that Egypt have got a maximum 6 points, Nigeria have got 4, Tanzania have got 1, and Chad have got 0. And come March 23 to 26, it'll be Chad against Tanzania in what I suspect will be the first part of a battle for third place. And then there isn't going to be a bigger qualifier in the 2017 competition. It's the two games in Nigeria and Egypt between the Super Eagles and the Pharaohs. Can't wait for those, Sonny, even though it's still a few months away.
In fact, David, those Egypt-Nigeria matches are more than 6 months away. At the end of March 2016, Nigeria will host the first one, and then the next qualifier will be in Egypt. And our African football guru, David Legg, will be back on Friday's Sunny Side of Sports with more soccer-licious commentary about the 2017 Nations Cup qualifying competition.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
You need to get to the net. And this reminder for our VOA basketball fans, on Friday, the Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo will be officially enshrined in the Basketball Hall of Fame, located in the northeastern U.S. city of Springfield, Massachusetts. In New York City, the women's semifinals are in the spotlight later Thursday night at the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament in New York. Top seed and world number one Serena Williams continues her quest for a fourth consecutive U.S. Open trophy and a calendar year Grand Slam when she plays the Italian Roberta Vinci. And in the second semifinal, another Italian, Flavia Panetta, is matched against Romania's Simona Halep. The men's semifinals are Friday in New York. Top seed and world number one Novak Djokovic of Serbia will play defending champion Marin Cilic of Croatia. And the second semifinal will be an all-Swiss encounter between Roger Federer and Stan Wawrinka. I watched Federer's 87-minute demolition of Frenchman Richard Gasquet on Wednesday night, and based partly on that masterful performance, I'm picking Roger Federer and Serena Williams to lift the trophies this weekend in New York. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the fourth part of a series on a dangerous South African township. And next, efforts to improve educational standards in Cameroon. But first, music. Here is Angelique Kidjo from Benin with Agolo.
Yeah.
From Benin, Angelique Kijo with Agolo.
Well, what's it like to be a police officer in one of the most dangerous places in crime-ridden South Africa? Diep Sloot is a vast, impoverished township on the northern outskirts of Johannesburg. The residents accuse the police of failing to protect them from the criminals. But as Darren Taylor reports in the fourth part of her series, this is just a small part of the story. In the following insert, we've disguised the voice of the police source and have withheld his name at his request.
Sullen young men sit on cracked plastic chairs in a tavern in Diep Sloot, sucking on big brown bottles of beer. The air's thick with cigarette smoke and suspicion. A policeman in black jeans and a blue tracksuit top remembers being here a few weeks ago. He points to a spot on the stained floor and recalls the body, a scarlet stream flowing from a gaping wound in the victim's neck.
Every single shift, I'm facing very difficult situations where I can see people being killed in a pool of blood.
The officer says Diep Sloot is the most dangerous, evil place he's ever worked. He adds that the congested township with its 600,000 residents, who mostly live in a massive maze of shacks, is the perfect hideout for criminals. The police member watches some men in the shabby bar as they argue over a game of pool. It's a cold night, but a woman hunched in a corner is dressed only in a white bra and brown shorts. She coughs through rotten teeth and her eyes roll in her head. The cop says all the violence he's seen in Diep Sloot has numbed him. He breathes, "When I am on duty, I am like a machine."
Even when they're shooting the gunshots, I don't feel anything because I'm used to this place. I don't feel anything.
He acknowledges that the criminals are the true rulers of Diep Sloot because they are many and the police are few.
They shoot. When they see the police, they shoot. They sometimes shoot our vehicles.
Frustration bubbles from his mouth when he seethes. "I don't know why police carry firearms anymore, because the law is for the criminals and is against us."
Our hands are tied because you can't just shoot. You must wait for them to shoot, then you can shoot.
By that time, he maintains, the police officers are wounded or dead. He says he's watched more than a few colleagues being killed by criminals. He always carries his gun, even when off duty, because thugs often approach him on the street. The policeman tells of a recent confrontation with one of Diep Sloot's gangsters.
"He told me that I once arrested him and I pointed him out with a firearm. They always threaten us. They know our cars. Anything can happen. That's it. There's nothing I can do. I've been attacked before."
But the community doesn't have much sympathy for police officers. Not when the people themselves are under siege from criminals who murder, rob, and rape them with seeming impunity. The cop patrols a street packed with taxis and pedestrians. An assortment of music blares from shops selling everything from fried chicken feet and heads to pornographic DVDs and fake branded clothing. Here, Peter Ndlozi hisses in disgust at the mention of the police. His reaction is typical of many residents' attitude towards the officers who should be protecting them.
"See around here, police is not working. Was good before, but not now."
"Why not?"
"Yeah, because everything is money."
"So you say when you need the police to help you, you must pay them money?"
"Yeah, yeah."
In Diep Sloot, frustrated and angry residents no longer wait for the police to arrest alleged criminals. The officer says they often corner the suspects themselves and bludgeon and burn them to death.
"They feel like the police are not doing their job. We are trying to do our job. We're trying the best we can. But with the shortage of members, resources, that's where we fail somewhere, somehow."
A huge police station built in Diep Sloot 5 years ago is empty. Government officials say the state has failed to staff it because of administrative chaos. The Dipsuit police are forced to work from a tiny temporary office. The policeman says the massive township is hardly ever patrolled by more than two vehicles and four officers, making it impossible for the cops to enforce law and order. Community journalist Golden Tika agrees.
I wouldn't put much of the blame on the police because I've worked very closely with these guys and I can see that they are understaffed. These guys are under pressure, serious under pressure.
The cop says he understands why the community takes the law into its own hands. He emphasizes that the police are just as angry as the residents because both the policing and the judicial systems are failing. So criminals are Dipsluit's overlords.
There's nothing you can do. Arrest that person tomorrow morning or next week, he's out there. You're staying here, you're working here. He can kill you anytime. He can come to your house and kill you anytime.
A police car speeds out of the temporary police station in Dipsluit. The policeman looks at the blue sky, at a police helicopter on its way to a crime scene in another part of Johannesburg. Hated by criminals and by the people he tries to protect, with his life in constant peril, why does he remain a police officer? He sighs and says the answer is simple.
I love being a cop, but I don't love working in Dipsluit.
He has applied time and again to be transferred elsewhere without success. He says he must leave Dipsluit as soon as possible, because what use will he be to anyone as a dead cop? I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Dipsluit, South Africa.
Children in rural Cameroon generally receive a poor education, if any education at all. But the government is betting that learning by computer can help fill the gap. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
9-year-old Charles Ngam Eboa lives in Bari, a small village in southwestern Cameroon. He speaks French and English despite never having attended school. When Charles was 2, his father returned home from Yaoundé, where he had been educated. He introduced his son to the computer.
I started talking when I was 1.5. Then at 2 years old, they started taking me to read letters and count numbers. I learned human biology, botany, and zoology. Physics, I'll learn it when I'm bigger.
Charles now helps other children in the village. He and his father have 2 laptops, 3 tablets, and a generator to keep the devices powered up. They download free educational applications from the internet and use search engines to find new material. According to Cameroon's Institute of Statistics, 70% of children in rural areas do not go to school because of poverty or because schools are too far away or are not adequately staffed. Illiteracy rates in rural areas are high. Charles's father, Ebwangoti, says electronic learning or e-learning could be a solution. He says his son is an example.
He's a pure e-learner. He's never attended any traditional school, never. He learns essentially at home, and when he goes to school, he assists with tutorials essentially. For example, we can teach him mathematics, and after we give him tutorials to explain to other students who are much more older than him.
The government of Cameroon is fully behind the idea. Workers recently began constructing the first of a projected 200 computer centers around the country. The centers, with about 20 computers each, are designed to promote e-learning in rural areas. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fostering economic development in sub-Saharan Africa is a top priority of the United States, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, is the centerpiece of our trade policy on the continent. Government officials, business leaders, and civil society from African countries and the U.S. are meeting in Gabon's capital, Libreville, this week to discuss how AGOA, now 15 years old, can provide even more business and investment opportunities for Africa's people today and into the future. Statistics support a growing consensus in both Africa and the United States that freer trade and increased international investment are critical to spurring economic development and reducing poverty. The U.S. Congress enacted AGOA in May 2000, providing a wide range of African products duty-free access to the U.S. market. AGOA has succeeded in helping eligible nations grow, diversify their exports to the United States, and create employment and inclusive economic growth. By 2014, African countries' non-oil AGOA exports to the United States were valued at $4.4 billion, up roughly 250% from 2001. The growth of these non-oil industries has spurred an estimated 300,000 direct jobs in beneficiary countries. AGOA's success won overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, which this summer voted to reauthorize the program for another 10 years. That underscores our nation's commitment to a stronger U.S.-Africa trade relationship and support for the region's long-term economic growth. The new AGOA legislation has an added clause, specifically calling for the promotion of the role of women in social, political, and economic development in sub-Saharan Africa. This acknowledges the vital role that women play as economic and civic leaders across the continent. Discussions during this year's forum will explore ways to build strong, export-oriented businesses and prepare African women producers to integrate more fully into regional and global supply chains. The 2015 forum will provide an opportunity to celebrate the recent reauthorization of AGOA, take stock of its successes over the last 15 years, look to the next 10, and launch a dialogue on our shared vision for the future of U.S.-Africa trade.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.